Petition 0907 in the matter of amendment of Chapter 72 of the Supreme Court rules relating to expunction. I usually have here a draft of the statements of the petitioners and all those who are going to appear, which is a long number, and I don't. It's now time for me to do a song and dance, which I'm going to refrain from doing. There were so many additions to the list that the marshal thought it would be better if we did not proceed with the original type list and that a new list be brought. So we will wait for that. I will tell you that John Velter, who I'm also supplied with cough drops, even if I don't have the list. John Velker, who is the director of state courts and who has submitted a comment on these proposals, cannot be here today because he's due at the Clerks Institute. So I should ask everyone who is going to appear to, if they've had an opportunity to read the statements that are numerous, and also because of the lengthy list, we're going to have a limit on time for everyone. And when I see the list and the length, I'll figure a time. But it's rather important that everyone who appears get an opportunity, but that you try not to repeat matters that are stated by speakers who precede you. Merely say you agree with that comment. That would be very helpful to us. Is the president of the State Bar going to make the petition comments, the initial comments on the petition? Pardon me? No. Okay. Well, my guess was right, and you're the first on my list, Mr. Kammer.
Court. This is a petition from the State Bar of Wisconsin. It's a petition that was unanimously supported by our Board of Governors and was supported by a wide margin in the criminal law section and the individual rights and responsibilities section. It has to do, of course, with Chapter 72 of the Supreme Court rules. Addressing the court on behalf of the State Bar will be Attorney Eric Gunther of Madison, and later in the hearing, and without further announcement, will be Jerry Maurice, former president of the State Bar, and my friend. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kammer. We'll call on Mr. Gunther. Mr. Gunther, you're going to get 15 minutes. Each of the other speakers is going to get 10. That includes questions. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. Good morning, members of the court. May it please the court, I appear on behalf of the State Bar of Wisconsin with respect to this petition. I've had the opportunity to review, I believe, all of the written submissions filed both in support and in opposition to the current language. The petition before you is not intended, nor is it any change in the law. What this addresses is a concern that we've seen in the trial courts, both of the sections as well as members of the State Bar Board of Governors. There is a specific statute, 973.015, that addresses expungement, as well as the current Supreme Court Rule 72, which address expungement. And we have trial judges serving our 72 counties, making determinations on expungement requests that go beyond that statute. And those requests are made premised upon the inherent authority and equitable authority of the court and the authority of the court to control its own records. That's perhaps best illustrated by the U.S. Supreme Court case of Nixon versus Warner Communications. And what we see are distinctions based upon the availability of counsel between individuals that can afford private attorneys and individuals that have counsel appointed through the state public defender's office. And I offer an example. Someone comes to see me prior to charging, and they have an allegation of, let's say, a sexual assault. What I would do is find out, and they explain that they have an alibi. They're somewhere in a completely different place from where the allegation is alleged to have taken place. What I would do is document that, provide it to the district attorney, and have, in circumstances, shown the district attorney that the allegation's not possible, and the district attorney correctly chooses to not issue a criminal charge. No court record is created in that instance. If, on the other hand, that individual is not in a position to afford private counsel, they have a lawyer appointed through the public defender's office, if deemed eligible, a criminal charge issues, and perhaps early in that case, the same information is obtained by their public defender, provided to the district attorney, and the district attorney, now having that new information, makes a decision not to proceed with the charge, and the case is dismissed. In that instance, a criminal record showing that charge will be maintained for at least 75 years in a felony sexual assault. When one goes to the courthouse to view that record, a court file will exist. When one types that individual's name on the circuit court access program, they will see that they were charged with a sexual assault and see that that charge was dismissed. These are records that are very commonly understood. You've seen in the written submission sociology professor Deborah Pager's work that shows that that misunderstanding exists in, with respect to degree, but exists whether there was a conviction and also exists in employment when there is no conviction, even in circumstances if the trial judge authored a letter to the potential employer saying that this person was innocent. And when that record's created for the individual whose case was dismissed, the court has the power, I believe, and the state bar believes, to expunge beyond that which is prescribed in the expungement statute 973.015, based upon, again, the inherent and equitable authority of the court. In Nixon versus Warner Communications, 435 U.S. 589 at 598, the U.S. Supreme Court stated, "It is uncontested, however, that the right to inspect and copy judicial records is not absolute. Every court has supervisory power over its own records and files, and access has been denied where the court files might have become a vehicle for improper purposes." It goes on to note that it's difficult to distill from the relatively few judicial decisions a comprehensive definition of what is referred to as the common law right of access, or to identify all the factors to be weighed in determining whether access is appropriate.
Counsel?
Yes?
I didn't want to interrupt you in your first 3 minutes, but they're over now.
Okay.
At the very beginning, I thought I heard you say that this amended petition, was not meant to be a change in the law. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
I view that there are several changes in the law with regard to this amended petition. One has to deal with age. As I read the amended petition, there's no age limit. Current law provides an age limit of 25 years of age. Secondly, the proposal doesn't limit cases eligibility for expungement just to the misdemeanor or low-level felonies, as current law does. And the current law limits the ability of the court to expunge at time of sentencing. The proposed amendment does not. So it seems to me that the proposed amendment does intend to change current law. Could you respond to those three areas where I perceive a change? Maybe I'm wrong.
Certainly. Thank you. I am in agreement with you as to the three points that you made. This is beyond that authority that's prescribed by the legislature in the statute, and it's a question of separation of powers. This court, as described in the Nixon opinion, and as suggested by this court in the interest of EC, has power over its own records. And the state bar is of the position that that's premised upon both inherent authority of the court, as well as its sister, equitable authority of the court.
So if I asked someone yesterday, what's the law with regard to expungement in this state? They would have said 25 years, misdemeanors, low felonies, and at the time of sentencing. So I'm missing something. Missing something in your statement. It seems to me you're arguing then that maybe this court has always had inherent authority, you know, ab initio, and therefore that law trumps the legislative law that I've just enunciated and recently passed, by the way, legislative.
Your Honor, you're certainly correct with respect to the statute. At the trial level, I've had made the argument based on equitable authority and inherent authority, and depending on where, what judge I'm in front of, I've been successful or not successful. I know a number of other lawyers that have as well. I've had situations where the prosecutor has said, kind of echoing your point, I'm in support of expunging this case if you can show me where I can do it. And I provide the trial judge with a submission very similar to that I provided to the court. So right now the issue is you have 72 counties and 246 trial judges making individual determinations, and the state bar feels that this court ought address that issue, and we believe that there is inherent authority and equitable authority beyond that specifically prescribed in the statute, and courts have the power to control its own records because they are courts. Article 1, Section 9 provides that essentially when there's a wrong, there's a remedy. And when an individual comes before the court, there's an acquittal or a dismissal, and they're continued to be harmed by this record. When, again, if someone had the opportunity for private counsel, no charge would have issued. So you're entirely correct. I'm in agreement with you that it is beyond that specifically prescribed by the statute. It is something that trial judges do right now in the right circumstances. We're asking that the court make it more clear to the contours of that inherent authority, but I don't believe that it's creating any new law. This is a power that I think the court has.
I will confirm on the basis of my various county trips that within each county, the judges view their powers of expungement very differently. The lawyers are, depending on which judge they're before, may have a different result on expungement. And it differs not only within counties, but from county to county. CCAP was quite surprised about orders of expungement in light of the fact that not everyone was doing it and that the statute was limited. So what you say, Counselor, is conforms to what I believe is the inconsistent practice around the state regarding what judges believe should be done.
Counselor, how do you think this interacts with the legislative directive in regard to open records found in Chapter 19 of the statutes?
Open records are governed by 19.31 to 39, and in crafting the language to our proposal, we're applying a balancing test in what we propose that is akin to that in the open records law and also akin to the specific expungement statute. It's important to note that the decision under this proposal as to whether a case ought to be expunged is something that takes place in a public noticed hearing. And anyone that has objection in that particular case, if the court were to adopt this proposal, would have the opportunity to be heard. So it requires a balancing test very much like the open records law. Indeed, this was modeled after both 973.015 and that balancing test, which itself is modeled after the state open records law.
Where does it say it has to be done in open court?
Second, Your Honor.
I got a big book and I may miss things.
Your Honor, in the proposed 72.06, what we discuss at sub C, it requires at C sub 2 that the court makes a finding either at dismissal or within the reasonable period of time thereafter that a party to the case would benefit, society would not be harmed by expunction. It's intended that that be done at a hearing.
It doesn't say that the two lawyers can't come in with a stipulation, and the judge signed it.
I believe that's a fair reading, Your Honor. The intention was
yours.
I believe it's certainly intended that it be through a public hearing.
You're going to advise the media?
Pardon?
Advise the media in any special way or any of the other interested groups that keep records like this?
Your Honor, right now when these take place, it just notices, I believe, most typically as a motion hearing, and specifically noting what the motion hearing is for, I believe is certainly appropriate.
Okay. Counsel, how does
we
this
intend
comport?
A public hearing?
Yes.
Okay.
Certainly.
How does this comport with the idea that under 973.015, expunction needs to be ordered at the time of sentencing?
Thank you. How that functions in practice is what a trial judge will do in almost every circumstance is say, I'm going to place you on probation for a year and withhold sentence. I find that if you successfully complete probation, you can come back to me and I will order expunction. So in practice right now, it doesn't function as the statute reads on its face. I believe that it's more appropriate that the proposed rules read as the statute actually functions. I've seen very rarely a court order expunction right at the time of sentencing. So
that's what the statute says. I mean, I was a trial court judge. That's what I did because that's what the statute says. And it has certain parameters as to what you can and cannot do. You may want the law to be something else, but that doesn't mean that it is. So you're going to have to help me with this because the law says one thing. And whether in practice it's being done different ways in different counties is another thing. And, you know, judges view their role very differently, depending on where they come from. But I think that as a judge, you have to actually follow what the law says, whether you like it or not. So help me out with that. How does that work with what you're suggesting? I may like what you're saying. I have been in situations where I wanted to order expunction for someone who was convicted of something that I thought, gee, you know, this is basically going to wreck the rest of their life, right? But it's not up to me as a judge to invent the law. That's a legislative determination. So I need some help from you on that because I understand you're approaching this from a practical viewpoint, and I'm a practical person too, but you also need consistency, and you got to expect the judges to follow the legal parameters of what is and isn't appropriate.
First, with respect to consistency, that's why I'm here on behalf of the State Bar, because as the Chief Justice has noted, in the 69 courts serving our 72 counties, different things are done. With respect to your point, I believe that what trial judges are doing, again, they're finding that that expunction would be appropriate, and then they condition it. If you do A, B, and C and come back to me in a year. That's how they're doing that in practice. So they're making the finding for expunction at the time of sentencing, which I think they can argue comports with the statute. That's why they're doing it that way. But they're allowing that window of time so that they can make sure that that balancing test, that the public won't be harmed.
Okay, so under your proposal, it still is done at the time of sentencing. This isn't an after the fact, gee, we'd like the record expunged sort of thing.
Under the proposal, it would allow, under the inherent and equitable authority of the court, for one to come back at a later time. So, for example, if someone says, I had a case where a gentleman had a sexual assault case dismissed, where we proved it didn't happen. And he said, I want the court file to be there because I want people to be able to read the paperwork and see that I didn't do this. Now, he was able to be successful moving forward in his career, but if he wasn't, if nobody read that court file and they just saw that there was a charge that was dismissed and nobody would hire him, in 5 years he could return to the court under this proposal and ask the court, premised upon its equitable authority, to take action to expunge that court file.
It's not that I'm not sympathetic to what you're saying, because I've been in that situation where I wanted to pretend the law was something other than what the statute said. Having said that, that's not the role of a judge. The role of a judge is to follow what the statute says, whether you like it or not. That's the rub that I have with what you're proposing, so you have to help me out with that.
Sure.
Counsel, let me suggest with regard to that, what you're really going to have to push then is the inherent authority. I mean, that's what you're all about here today,
yes,
as I understand it.
Yes.
Inherent authority is the law, and it trumps the statute. That's what your argument is.
That's correct. And Justice Ziegler, I would point to this court's opinion in the interest of EC, and there the court defined equitable authority, quote, is a variant of the inherent authority doctrine. It permits a court to grant equitable remedies to private litigants in situations where there is no explicit statutory authority or in which the available legal remedy is inadequate to do complete justice. And that's what we're asking here. The bar believes that the statute isn't sufficient to do complete justice. Justice Ziegler, as you noted, there are times when you wanted to do that and felt that as a trial court judge, you didn't have that authority. That's what we're asking, so that this court defines the contours of the equitable and inherent authority of courts to have the power to do complete justice.
Counselor, wouldn't you be better taking your petition to the legislature? Because the legislature has said you must do it at sentencing. I just don't see how you can say the inherent authority provides a remedy at any time a judge chooses to give it when the legislature has spoken. I mean, if you really believe there's a need for this, and I'm not, you know, opposed to what you're telling me, you need to talk to the legislature about it. They have said at sentencing. I don't see how you can say the inherent authority fills that void when there's not a void. What you read to us said when there is no express condition. Well, the legislature has spoken, and they may well speak again on it, but I don't see how you can say we can have inherent authority to override a statute. That's a new concept.
Your Honor, I would disagree. I believe that equitable authority does provide, and again, citing to this court's opinion and in the interest of EC, does provide for authority where there is no specific statutory grant.
But there is here.
Or,
they said at sentencing. How do you say that's not a specific statutory statement?
This court's opinion also provides that when that authority is inadequate, the legal remedy is inadequate to do complete justice. And imagine this, Your Honor, when someone makes the choice, they could go forward, the prosecutor says, we can dismiss this felony charge, or you plead guilty and we'll reduce it to a misdemeanor, and the person's innocent. And if they stay forward, their case is ultimately dismissed or they're acquitted before a jury. In a felony case, that would continue on for 75 years. But if they pled guilty to something they didn't do, the court record's gone. And we're not asking the court, if this court does what the bar requests, this would not expunge a single case. What this does is clarify what determination a trial court is to make.
Now, and my concern is the conflict with the legislation, Counsel.
Your Honor, with respect to the legislature, mm-hmm. I can tell you that we're before this branch of government for a reason. The bar's been before that branch of government. And so we're asking, again, this is premised upon the authority of the court, because it is a court, to control its own records. There was a question with respect in some of the submissions about law enforcement records. This is no effect over law enforcement records. This court's opinion, again, in the interest of EC, says we're the court. We don't have power over somebody else's record. So the scenario of the officer pulling someone over, not seeing that there was a prior arrest, that's not going to happen. Law enforcement uses the PROTECT database, a completely different document.
Counsel, I wonder how concerned we should be about unintended consequences. As a former trial court judge and former district attorney, there were any number of times where, as part of a plea agreement, I either accepted and approved of an expungement request or offered it as part of a plea resolution. Certainly in the appropriate case, I think any reasonable, fair-minded person would say, yes, expungement is appropriate in some cases. But I wonder how concerned this court ought to be in regard to this petition as to the unintended consequences. We know, for instance, there are all sorts of private companies out there that collect and capture certain data. And it's not as if this petition were to be granted and the rules either clarified in your view or changed in some others' views, that people are going to stop wanting to know about this information, either in regard to their elected officials, the district attorney, the circuit court judge, or for whatever reason. And so how concerned should we be about the fact that if people win, people still want that information, they're not going to be able to go to the courthouse and pay whatever the photocopying fees are. They're going to have to go to some private company and pay whatever the company wants to charge.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to private companies funding and access to that data, we've had our state statute originally governing misdemeanors for folks of a limited age range, and we haven't seen that problem in, I believe, 3 decades. So I don't know that that's a concern. For your work with a prosecutor, or as a prosecutor, it reminds me of a point I wanted to make, which is there can be a decision made at the time of sentencing, just like there is now, part of the agreement in a plea, that the accused would never seek expungement. And so that's no different than now. What we're talking about is cases of dismissal or acquittal. There's a third point that's addressed in the petition, and that is when the retention period has already expired. And all that means is, if I've got an ordinance case that should exist for 5 years, or the retention period is 5 years, if I were to go to the courthouse, find out it's there after year 8 because they haven't had the time to go through those files, I could write a letter to the judge and say, Your Honor, could you just get rid of this file? It's past the time it's supposed to exist.
I suppose the response to part of your answer, though, might be that in years past, the expungement avenues have been interpreted as relatively narrow and constricted, with the judge at the time of sentencing finding the eligibility, which is how I used to do it as a trial court judge. At the time of sentencing, you make the requisite finding about society not being harmed and the individual being benefited, and you say that they're eligible for expungement upon application, upon the successful completion of all of the terms. But now with this petition, opening it up to every applicant, potentially, then the question is going to get larger, and the number of questions might get larger. So therefore, the private companies might find a little more profit incentive to start collecting that debt and selling it.
I doubt that that's correct, Your Honor, because this already takes place. The issue is one that the framework that a trial judge uses to make that decision varies from judge to judge. Trial judges right now have, without regard to
we should work on getting a little uniformity with what's there now, as opposed to opening it up for everything else.
Well, it's already opened up, and that's what the bar is asking. We're saying that the trial judges already in some courts will understand the depth of the inherent and equitable authority and will act beyond the statute. And we're asking this court to make a decision to address that uniformity. The bar unanimously hopes that the court finds that the equitable and inherent authority includes that which we adopt and ask the court to adopt in the petition.
Because it's discretionary, however.
It is discretionary.
There will be great variation from judge to judge and county to county. You agree with that?
We would create?
Well, there would be, if this rule were adopted, great variation from county to county and judge to judge.
I expect that it would be significantly less variation than that which you've seen.
Now, okay. But there's still, the concept of variation is still there.
That's correct. With any judge, they would now have essentially a balancing test that's defined, that's premised upon the Nixon opinion and the EC opinion, and that would provide guidance. I think that that would allow litigants with perhaps less sophisticated counsel to be heard in these matters. Otherwise, you know, it requires the 15 pages or so that we provided to you in order to describe the contours of the equitable and inherent authority. So I think it would limit the variation that we see already between county to county.
Counsel, if I were a judge following the statute, under your theory, I could say, boy, this is a misdemeanor, but they turned 22 the month that this offense was committed, and so they don't qualify. But if someone were convicted of a felony, and they were 22 at the time the offense was committed, then I could expunge their record.
The statute's changed a bit to allow felonies and folks up to 25, but to the point, yes, it would allow authority beyond that.
So someone could have a felony expunged, but if the judge is following the statute, a misdemeanor couldn't be.
Not exactly. The current statute allows expungement of some felonies explicitly, but this would, the intention is to, for this court to advise trial judges, again, if the petition's filed, that they have the inherent and equitable authority to expunge in any case when they make that individualized determination.
So where's the stopping point? If I decide, you know, I want to sentence somebody, and gee, I don't think that 40 years is enough. They should have life for this. Should I just say, you know, this crime is so bad that I'm not going to follow the statute and what the penalties are? At what point do we say that a judge's inherent authority stops and the legislature actually has a say?
Well, inherent and equitable authority is essentially, it's designed to provide complete justice to the appealing party when the statute doesn't do so. I believe that if the court were inclined to penalize somebody beyond that authorized by the statute, that would likely offend the rule of lenity, and there's a pretty clear history in the case law that can't be done. I think in contrast, here the history favors and makes clear both by this court and the U.S. Supreme Court that there is the authority for the court to control access to its own records.
Counsel, I'm assuming that you agree that expungement is a matter for the legislature and the courts.
Yes.
It is not only the courts.
I would agree.
In your position, it's not only the legislature. I mean, that's your position.
Yes, Your Honor.
And unless you take that position that it is a joint effort, or at least a fits within that middle ground of not exclusively legislative and not exclusively judicial, but in that middle range, which most things tend to fall, as recognized in our opinions, unless you take that, then you can't, the court cannot write this kind of rule. The court must rule to even consider this, must view expungement is within its powers and the legislative powers.
That's correct.
Okay. Counsel?
Yes.
We were supposed to give you 15 minutes. We're now, even with my song and dance, at 35 minutes. So, what's your most important point that you haven't made? Make it. And we'll give you an opportunity at the end to respond.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. I wanted to note that within that balancing test of harm to society, that society would not be harmed and that the individual would benefit, if the court were to adopt this petition, they can certainly consider, a trial judge could consider the contours of the statute. So in other words, to find that society would not be harmed and the individual would benefit, they could look to the statute and say, you're asking me in this instance to go beyond that authorized by the legislature. I'm going to hold you to something more when I'm doing that balancing. And then my final point, this is an issue that the bar believes, as the Chief Justice noted, is something where there is differences in how it's interpreted throughout the state, and we're asking the court to for guidance on that. And I appreciate the court's time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gunther, and the court appreciates the care and the consideration on an issue that is obviously very important to many people, as well as the court system, and as well as the public as a whole. Thank you. I now have 29 people on my list, and so I'm going to drop to 8 minutes per person, please. We're going to take time. Within the last couple of days, I've been requested to allow people to come or to write us using their first names only, because the usual custom here is you state your name and affiliation. I advised our staff person that I'd permit that, because this whole thing is a privacy issue and people who are appearing or writing might not want their full names in a public record in concern. I also advised everybody, and I'm advising you all now, that the Wisconsin Eye is taking audio-visual of this. There's the camera with the red light back there, and that's directed at me, I hope. And that when somebody stands at the podium, usually that camera, red light, is on. The Wisconsin Eye might, in certain places in the state, be live. If not, in other parts of the state, it may be put on at hours that Wisconsin Eye wants. And they also archive these tapes. So when anyone comes to the podium, I want you to know that, because these will not be turned off. Okay? Everybody understand that? Any objections from the court? Hearing none, Peter Fox, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Newspaper Association. Fox.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, members of the court. In view of the number of people who wish to comment on this proposal, I'll just be very succinct.
You also submitted something in writing, and it's in the judge's binder at tab 20.
Thank you very much. So I'll be just very succinct and acknowledge that this is a matter of great public interest and public policy. As we all know, there have been legislative attempts to address the issue of expunction. A recent amendment to the current state budget bill carried a provision for that. And the concern of the Wisconsin Newspaper Association is that this question needs to be addressed in its wholeness, a holistic approach rather than a piecemeal approach, which is how we have viewed it up to this point. There's so many aspects to it. I have served on the most recent WCCA CCAP Oversight Committee, and there are absolutely issues of concern for people who have been, in their eyes, wronged by an arrest, wronged by a conviction. Absolute black and white line seems to be evading us as we look at fairness. And so our association's position is that this petition, in our viewpoint, does not permit a greater public policy discussion of the issue of expungement. And so for that reason, we would urge the court to reject it. And we don't have at this moment a better solution on how to come up with the discussion, the public policy discussion of expungement, but we do maintain that discussion must be held by the citizens of the state.
You know, we have, I think it's coming up later in the day, if we ever get to it, a record retention, you may not know, a petition, because 50 or 75 years records are removed. Never have heard any objection to that because of the length of time. Is that it?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, we do destroy, that is, remove records after a length of time, which varies depending on the nature of the allegations in the records. So felony, I've forgotten whether it was 50 years or more. That doesn't bother you.
No, we're aware of the schedule.
That's right. That's what I'm talking about.
Yes, indeed. We're aware of the schedule. If I may drop back to 2004, I have to say, Chief, that you were, at that time, you sounded an alarm as we moved into an era of more records becoming electronic. And at that time, you urged the state to take a look at the ramifications of this because we were just beginning to understand it. And recently, Governor Doyle even addressed this and indicated that there's something unique about the presence of so many records that are now online. It almost takes on a different character, the online records in this particular arena, court records, personal records, records that affect people's lives. There's a different quality to those records that are available electronically and available worldwide from those same records that are available on paper at the courthouse. And I think we need to get our arms around that as a state and as a citizenship in Wisconsin.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. Justice Prosser.
The Wisconsin Newspaper Association wants the court to reject the petition. Is that right?
That is correct, sir.
Would you want us to do anything else?
Well, frankly, I don't know what options are available to the court, so I have to plead ignorance on options available to the court.
Well, you think it's worthwhile? The court has, and I won't have the years down right, but at least twice had an oversight committee. I think you made reference to the last one, in which it brought together a very diverse group of interests, trying to get as many viewpoints at the table as possible. And as a result of that, the court made significant changes, I think, in WCCA to assist in protecting privacy and to give the viewer of these records a better concept of what they mean. So you got the executive summary, saying, hey, if you're acquitted, it means
not found guilty. If it's dismissed, it means you didn't find guilty, so, and be careful how you use these records. Now, that's exactly what it says, but that's the intent. Also, as a result of that committee, the court, CCAP, put dismissals up against the charges, so you didn't have to scroll further. You saw right away, hey, this didn't go. And that, too, was desired as a protection. Now, it doesn't go as far as expungement. So this is a big wind-up because I wanted people here who are not familiar with that to know that record. It's a big wind-up in response to Justice Prosser, whether or not it would be desirable to try another committee and see where else you go. I don't know.
The last oversight committee had quite a range of issues to look at, and the issue of records availability and presentation was just one aspect of it. I think the committee got as far as it could. It was a very diverse committee, but as diverse as it was, we still didn't have enough of a representation from various constituencies, I might say. And I don't think we drilled down on the issue deep enough. Mm-hmm. And yes, indeed, the WCCA portion of the CCAP program does contain those disclaimers and those cautions. But I think that we could agree that they may not go far enough. Mm-hmm. Yes, I can see that a charge has been dismissed. There's a presumption of innocence, but I think as reasonable people, we can agree that there's still an issue of taint. That being said, there's another consideration to be made, and that is the value that the citizenry has to inspect its law enforcement and court system. And the value of the WCCA presentation is important to defendants and people who've been involved with the court system as well. At a recent legislative hearing, there was a man who testified that if it hadn't been for the complete transcript history of one of his friends who's now incarcerated, being available on CCAP, they wouldn't have been able to drill down and get this man a hearing on appeal. So there's the mop flops both ways. There's important considerations on both sides. But we aren't there yet. It's a very complex problem, and the nature of electronic records is different than the nature of records on paper.
Thank you, Mr. Thank
Thomas. You very kindly.
Miss Lisa Gluck, or is it Glick? Miss Glick, is it Glick or Gluck?
Glick.
Glick. Miss Glick also submitted a writing, and that is under tab 22 of the court's briefing.
Okay, honorable justices, I'm here in support of the State Bar Petition 0709, and I am supporting it because I feel that the current condition of CCAP, which is pretty unrestrained in its accessibility, damages the most vulnerable people in our state. I'm especially interested in this relative to the disparity with different racial groups and the frequency of arrest and judicial complication there. In looking into this, I was doing some research and came upon some information about the Special Committee on Expunction of Criminal Records, which was called to action because of ethical and privacy issues in 2006. It was a bipartisan committee, and they met...
Legislative.
I'm not a lawyer, so please forgive.
Oh, no, that's all right.
Okay, I'll make a lot of mistakes, so please correct.
I'm just clarifying that we're all talking about the same thing, because we've got a lot of committees referred to here.
Okay, well, apparently they met three times, and then because they weren't able to find common ground, they discontinued, and the person in charge of the chair of that committee was Representative Robin Voss. And I'm going to just quote briefly what he said as the committee was disbanding. No common ground between parties can be found. Thus, I have decided not to reconvene the committee for any additional meetings. The issues are numerous, complex, and fundamental, and present difficult public policy choices. To adequately deal with these issues, it may ultimately be necessary to consider them in a context much broader than civil and criminal court records. When I heard that, I realized that this was the legislature, I mean, apparently a legislatively assigned committee, and they were not able to come up with solutions. So that's why saying that it's something that the legislature should deal with is not necessarily working, because they had to disband. So anyway, I'm thinking that this is maybe the broader context that he was referring to, because where else do you turn? In my opinion, we need to think not just about exactly which cases we're looking at for expungement, but I think that there are some deeper issues. There are for me as a citizen. And I want to look at what kind of society do we want to create? There's a lot of fear in our country after the 9/11 and with the recession. And I think sometimes we're tending toward too much intrusion and too much judgment and not enough attention to the potential for rehabilitation and for feeling compassion for people who once make a mistake. I was reminded of the novel 1984 by George Orwell, where he talked about one of his big issues in that novel was the role of technology and the potential for oppression and monitoring and controlling people. He wrote this in 1949, before there were personal computers. I don't think our government is currently an oppressive government. In fact, I'm astonished that if you run into a problem in one area, like with the legislation in the House of Representatives, that AB 663, I don't know if everybody knows what that is, but it's an attempt to work on expunction there, and it seemed like there's so much political energy to oppose that, and then to find out that the state bar was coming to the Supreme Court. That just made me think, yes, this balance of powers is wonderful, and I appreciate it. But Orwell was talking about Big Brother, and he said that Big Brother symbolized two sides of government. There is the protective side and the side that we all want to turn to feel safe. And we have that much more in this country than almost anywhere else. But there's also another side to the government, and that can be, in the Big Brother symbolism, a threat. Because in that novel, you couldn't escape the gaze of Big Brother. I couldn't help but feel some parallel here, because speaking of an inescapable gaze, the gaze of all the people in our state. And I read recently, I hope it's not right, but it was in the Wisconsin Journal of Law or something like that, that there can be up to 5 million hits a day. I've heard more commonly 1 million hits a day, but that's a lot of people looking into personal lives and the kind of labels that come with these records are like, you are a criminal. Somebody may have done something once that was not a good thing, but should this be like a scarlet letter that sticks with you for the rest of your life and anybody can just look and see you made a mistake once. Maybe you were acquitted, maybe not. But I don't think it's the direction that I would like to see our country going in. I'd like to see more forgiveness and more belief in the rehabilitation potential of people. I feel more safe if I feel there's a balance between justice and fear and judgment and civil rights. And so I don't know whether to speak about my own family suffering. I turned in a probably tastelessly long testimony about my family. And I know under this particular petition that I will say that a loved one of mine has the NGRI ruling. He suffers from mental illness and was doing very well and is a lovely person. I love him very deeply. And that would not fall within the realm of this petition. But for me, this petition at least opens a door toward humanizing this system. So it isn't, it all seems so automatic, and we have to pause and see the forest through the trees and see who are we and where do we want to go? What kind of society do we want to have? And I'm just going to say one last thing. I'm really happy that Chief Justice Abramson, that you are the head of a study committee, it's called the Chief Justice's Criminal Justice Mental Health Initiative. Yes. And I am so happy about that. If there's any way that I can become involved with that, I have a huge interest in this area.
Ms. Glick, your letter was, I think, very helpful. And one of the things that I will do is talk with CCAP to see whether there is information on WCCA that relates to medical information that is confidential and, under the statutes. You cited 19.35
yes.
in your letter, and I will check that. My assumption is not, but sometimes things aren't exactly as some of us assume. So I did appreciate it. I did appreciate your sharing your information with us and pointing up this information. Of
thank
confidentiality.
You.
Ms. Owens, Teresa Owens is the staff person, will put your name down on our long list. I have to tell you that no initiative that has been begun in this court system since I've been chief has generated as much support and as much interest as this mental health initiative in the criminal justice system from across the state, from private citizens to public officials. So we're going to do our best.
Good. And I've done a lot of research and would be delighted to come and speak with anyone who would be willing to listen.
Ms. Owens has your name, address, and telephone number.
Thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you, Ms. Glick. Mr. and is it Moak or Moak?
Richard.
Good morning. I appreciate the opportunity to address the court, and I think I can have my presentation done in 5 minutes.
Thank you very much. If you've submitted something, I just can't find it quickly enough. But you don't have to have submitted a writing.
Did you
submit a writing?
No.
No. Okay, fine. I just wanted to make sure I had it in front of me.
Okay. I'm taking a medication that doesn't really allow me to break my train of thought, and so therefore I would ask if the court please, I'll answer any questions, but if you could do it at the end of my presentation, and that way I can also save the court some time. excuse me. I'm here to talk about CCAP, but before I talk about CCAP, I need to lay the groundwork in my particular case. And I'm here to talk about people that were innocent people and that were convicted and sent to prison and had their lives destroyed, and who continue to have their lives destroyed now by CCAP and their believers. I was sentenced, perhaps the court will remember the case. My case went on from 1997, and for 8.5 years thereafter was in La Crosse County. Judge Dennis Montalban. There was 4 jury trials involved for alleged crimes that never happened. They didn't get the wrong guy. There was no guy. The crimes never happened. I was given 165 years in prison. Judge Montalban mentioned that he wanted me to die in prison. I was 49 years old at the time. And he wanted me to die in prison so bad that he misinformed and misled the Court of Appeals in one of my trials, which was the 3rd and most important trial. The Court of Appeals, 4th District, they caught him in that mess and caused that court to reverse its own decision. All this happened as a result of a jury instruction conference in the 3rd trial. This would be the most important conversation that happened in this entire 8.5 years that I spent in court, either in trials or in the appellate process. When I say that he misled and misinformed the court, or anything else that I say here today, I would be gladly put to my proof on these matters, because what I'm saying here now are not my words, but they're in my words, but this is all in the record. I have some 9,000 pages in my case, and everything is in the record, and I don't exaggerate about anything in this entire matter. I'm the only one that told the complete truth and was consistent at all times, and this includes the judge, the assistant district attorney, Robin Matusik. The district attorney, the police officer involved, and the alleged victim. Also, in all of these trials, Judge Montalban was the judge in 3 of the 4 trials, and in all 3 of the trials, he made 3 different mistrial rulings, all in violation of the Constitution. After release, I went to the claims board seeking a declaration of innocence and the shameful amount of money allotted. They refused, indicating that I didn't meet the required statutory burden of proving my innocence with, quote, clear and convincing evidence. That evidence does not exist in my case because the so-called investigating officer in these 7 very serious crimes was a 21-year-old traffic cop with less than 3 years on the force. He was not an investigator. He never investigated anything. He was one step above a meter maid. He didn't collect DNA. He didn't take fingerprints. He didn't talk to witnesses who may have seen or heard something, including other policemen, 2 businesses, their customers, didn't search a bathroom, didn't search a dumpster, didn't search my car because he, quote, I didn't know he had a car. He was parked next to it. I allegedly hit somebody in the face 30 times, and he didn't check my hands for cuts or bruises or blood. He didn't check the parole status of the alleged victim or that person's history of lying to the police. Didn't call the parole agent, even though the alleged victim admitted he was drinking in a bar until 2 a.m. in the morning. Crimes were alleged to have been videotaped. He didn't even include that in his search warrant. He had never done a search warrant. He got caught lying under oath on the stand. Another cop at the police department was going to call in an investigator, which is police policy and procedure. This inexperienced traffic cop told him to never mind, I'll handle it. And there is much more about this traffic cop. This is how La Crosse County does business. While Scott Horn was a district attorney, and then he lied to Judge Montalban twice, once to get me the 165 years, and another time to stop me from getting a release on bond, pending one of my many appeals. Were it not for the intelligence of former attorney and law professor David Cook, I'd be another innocent lifer and die in prison. As a result of this courtroom corruption, I have lost my children and don't know my grandchildren. And that bears repeating. I've lost my children and my grandchildren. One of my brothers died, two uncles died, a cousin died, a friend died. I lost $400,000 in earnings and over 3,000 days and nights laying in a cage thinking about my children. When I was released by the actions of the 4th District Court of Appeals, this court, the 7th Circuit Court of Appeals, and the U.S. Supreme Court, they dropped me in Madison in the middle of winter with used prison clothes and gym shoes. I also lost all of my prior friends, job, home, money, vehicles, and all personal mementos and family pictures going back over 100 years. As a result of CCAP over the last 4 years, which is how long I've been out of prison crime-free, all that time I didn't know that they were supposed to put a disclaimer on top of their web pages talking and indicating that there was a presumption of innocence in my case and that they were supposed to be telling the public that my case was dismissed as they were required to do, and they didn't do any of that. As a result of the way I've been living for the last 4 years, the result of CCAP, I can't make a phone call. A simple thing like that, to make a phone call, because of caller ID and people going to look at CCAP, I can't call a business, I can't call a lawyer. If I want to get an upfront conference with a lawyer, which I've been doing, and I don't want them to know that until I get there, until I explain what's going on, because CCAP is definitely not going to explain it. As a matter of fact, in all these four trials that I pled not guilty so strongly, they've had on there for 4 years that I was pled no contest. That's absolutely ridiculous that they're allowed to put anything on there that they want to destroy a person's life. I can't socialize with my neighbors because of CCAP. I can't tell them what my name is. I can't get mail at my apartment because my neighbors might see it. I've lost two relationships with women because they went to CCAP, found out my real name, which I gave to them, and that ends my relationship with two good women since I've been out. I was given part in a movie filmed here in Wisconsin. When the casting company looked at CCAP, they reneged without reason. Was that a possible career destroyed? Could be. Dane County, I got one ticket right here. I was bow hunting with a disabled permit, and I didn't have my bow in a case. Dane County has it on CCAP as an uncased firearm. There's a big difference between a firearm and a bow and arrow. American citizens, and now the proponents of CCAP thinks this perhaps should go on for the rest of my life. In regard to everything that else has been destroyed. And not only my life, but hundreds of others that have been released, plus there's going to be thousands more across the country as more testing is done. And I just have one quote from the U.S. Supreme Court, and this was done by them in Fuller versus Oregon as early as 1974, before we even had to worry about CCAP and its destructive forces. That court noted that a defendant whose conviction is overturned on appeal has been seriously imposed upon by society without any conclusive demonstration that he is criminally culpable. His life has been interrupted and subject to great stress, and he may have incurred financial hardship through the loss of job and potential working hours. His reputation may have been greatly damaged. That's a very, very bad understatement in my case, because in my case, it's a thousand times worse, and they were looking at this 36 years ago.
Mr. Moa?
Ma'am?
Thank you for your presentation. Are there any questions?
Thank you,
ma'am. Thank you. Representative Marilyn Schneider. Morning.
Good morning, Chief. Honorable Chief Justices and Justices of the Supreme Court, thank you for allowing me to testify at this public hearing regarding the State Bar of Wisconsin petition. The last time I was in this court, I was under indictment for violating the state's open meetings law as a member of the Secret Seven. Justice Bradley, I think, worked here at that time, and may remember that. So it's nice to be back under this circumstance rather than under that one.
Keep that in mind as you proceed.
Me?
Keep that in mind as you proceed.
Okay. In my view, this court has created a monster, which is convicting innocent people in the court of public opinion, whether they did anything wrong or not, and is creating a circumstance in which both innocent and guilty people are being denied employment in Wisconsin in violation of Wisconsin's anti-discrimination laws. Others, like women compelled to seek shelter in domestic abuse shelters, are being denied housing because they had to file restraining orders against an abusive spouse. They find themselves listed on this CCAP database, impacting the lives of hundreds, perhaps thousands, of our citizens. Modern technology has put privacy and old-fashioned notions like forgiveness to rout. Computer data systems available on the World Wide Web make life miserable for those who find themselves listed on this system and unable to escape its tentacles. Somewhere, and the estimates vary, between 750,000 and 5 million hits occur on the CCAP system every day. This system is being used by employers, landlords, the press, and even as a dating service to snoop on each other, a far cry from the original intent of open meetings and open records laws. I was here in the post-Watergate period when we voted on those laws, and those laws were designed to let people know what their government was up to, not to snoop on each other. In the computer age, where technology allows constant surveillance, gigantic data systems, and massive assaults on the Constitution, there is no forgiveness or mercy anymore. The Bible tells us not to bear false witness against our neighbor, but this system does exactly that, because a data shadow follows all of us forever. With today's advanced technologies, nearly everything you do, from sending a text or an email, to shopping at the mall, to ordering a book online, to driving your car or making a phone call, a giant and never-ending data shadow is cast that will follow you and influence the quality of your life. In the last weeks, the press and landlords have launched a scurrilous attack on me, depicting changes I recommended for the Wisconsin Circuit Court automation system as, in quote on their website, "some Wisconsin legislators wish to blindfold the public so criminals can hide in our midst." The press has many articles lamenting on Schneider wants to bring a veil of secrecy down over civil and criminal court records. Changes within a long-standing system such as our courts are difficult at best, but I believe the time is right to make changes to the Wisconsin Circuit Court automation system. I support adoption of this state bar petition, which allows for removal of dismissals and acquittal for civil and criminal cases, or for which they were acquitted, to petition the circuit court to have their record expunged, including removal from CCAP. I also support adoption of the ability for a person to petition the court for the same relief after the mandatory retention time for criminal and civil records has passed. However, I have a serious concern with this, since often this is already a matter of decades, and I ask the court to seriously consider any efforts to extend the records retention time. If the court simply extends the retention time to 75 or 95 years, it undermines the entire purpose of this petition. Whether the press wants to believe it or not, the reason I have brought a bill to the drafting every session is in response to citizens being harmed by a system that is no longer functioning in the manner it was originally intended and is allowing for state-provided information so employers, landlords, and the press can use it to discriminate. Making the appropriate changes to avoid the coercive effects of this system is one of the toughest duties of all of our positions, but I believe it is one of the most important duties. I'd like to read to you just a few examples of people who have contacted my office, and in spite of the attacks on me over the exact number of letters we have received, I would present it to the court, the mail that I have received, and would like you to maintain the confidentiality of those who have requested it. Dr. Jamie Skevland has a doctorate degree in education. He's a school administrator in Minnesota. He said, in 2003, I was the recipient of a character assassination tactic used by my then wife as we were going through a contentious divorce. While I was completely innocent of the charges filed against me in 2003, CCAP does not begin to tell the whole story. In 2003, I was sentenced to 30 years of humiliation by having my name published on CCAP. Since then, I have interviewed for dozens of public school superintendent positions, mainly in Wisconsin. Wisconsin is our love. Wisconsin is where our families are. I have usually made it to being selected as the final two or three finalists. However, once the background check is conducted, people see the words disorderly conduct and battery next to my name. It doesn't matter that the charges against me were dismissed or that my wife later admitted in court that she fabricated the stories in an attempt to gain placement of our three children. Those latter facts do not appear on CCAP. The fact remains that CCAP is an unjust system of humiliation for innocent people such as me. I will never be able to serve as a public school superintendent in the state of Wisconsin for the rest of my life due to the damaging reference about me on CCAP. Employers do use it to discriminate. Mike Crawford. Several years ago, after filing for divorce, I was accused of several crimes by my ex-wife in an attempt to gain leverage in the divorce. While I have never been convicted of any crime, the public record that is on CCAP can easily make me seem like a horrible person. This record, I believe, has affected my ability to find employment and has affected personal relationships. My constituent from Westfield, Rex Olaf, I was falsely accused of sexually abusing my stepdaughter 10 minutes before a custody hearing in Portage in September of 2002. CCAP states that I'm acquitted and innocent after reading a page or two. The public only sees what I was charged with sexual abuse. In their eyes, I am guilty. I cannot get jobs and am constantly questioned by people in my family and friends if I did it or not. Marathon County Circuit Judge Vincent Howard. The only case that I have really had a problem with the availability of CCAP records is a case where a young woman about to get her college degree so that she could counsel youth, took a job with the Wausau Boys and Girls Club as a volunteer. Two high school boys were interested in her. They claimed that they had gone to her house when the parents were not around, and then she sexually assaulted them. She denied any interest in them or that they had ever been to her house. At the trial, it was clear that the boys had never been beyond sneaking a peek in the side window to the front door, misidentifying a basement room that could be observed from there for clothes washing drying room that was actually located on another floor. The jury found her not guilty. However, because of the boys' allegation, she has a record that means she cannot go into the vocation that she had wanted to. But even then in the past, the record would still have been available, not just so readily available. Good luck as you wrestle with the difficult and thorny issue. Now, I see my red light is on. But I have letters like this from police officers, our prison guards, when you talk about public safety, they are being accused all the time by prisoners, and they end up with records on CCAT. People are being branded for life because of this system. And I urge the court to help me in my fight to try to get the legislature to address some of these issues, because we ought not to be punishing innocent people for the things that they, especially what they didn't do, but even for those who committed a wrong. When employers and landlords use this to discriminate against them, it is simply wrong. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Schneider, do you have a suggestion for something short of expungement?
Do I have a suggestion? I don't know if I have a suggestion for that, except to try to keep some. The one major suggestion that I have is that records should not go on CCAP until there is a conviction or a settlement. The people, you know, like these folks that I mentioned, they weren't convicted of anything. This woman from Wausau, she's lost her whole career because of a false accusation. And it should never have, you know, until there was that conviction, it shouldn't be on CCAP. Those records are still available in the courtroom, I mean in the courthouse. They just shouldn't be available on the World Wide Web.
Representative, I think your intentions are very good here, and I think your motives are good. I wonder, though, if it's a matter of careful what you wish for about asking the court to start exercising inherent authority in direct, well, what could be in conflict with the statutes. I wonder why, I mean, these are compelling stories that these are compelling factual recitations that you are letting us know about. I wonder why this matter hasn't gained greater traction in the legislature.
That's simple. Legislators have to run for office every 2 years. We don't have the insulation that you do with a 10-year term, for example, or a lifetime appointment as in the federal court. And frankly, there is sometimes legislative initiatives take a while to take root. I've had bills on privacy and locker room privacy. It took me 10 years to get it through. This issue is somewhat relatively new. There is also the question that some people just disagree. And then there are those who are simply afraid of the press. So they won't take a stand on this issue. Because
you think that if legislators voted in favor of this, that it would be unpopular with the voters?
It would be unpopular with some voters. Over time, I've tried to change the legislation that I introduced. And no matter what I do, the press wants unfettered access to every single record there is. I even had one reporter tell me that he had a right to have access to my own personal medical records. I mean, there is no end to their desire to have access to every little bit of dirt on everybody.
Are there any other questions? Well, thank you very much. And on behalf of the court, I want to thank you because we all have worked together on a number of issues and have had committee meetings with the legislature to improve the administration of justice, both through legislative activities and through the court activities, and that you're a frequent visitor here and bring people to the Capitol so that they know their government better, including the courts. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief.
And when the court doors are closed, you're the first one that calls me. Cynthia Keeper. No? Thank you, Ms. Keeper. Bill Leaders, President, Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council.
Chief Justice Abrahamson, members of the court, thank you for the opportunity to speak to this issue. As outlined in the letter we submitted earlier this month, the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council considers the state bar's proposed changes unnecessary and unwise. I have served on several incarnations of the oversight committees that set policy for Wisconsin Circuit Court Access, or WCCA, commonly and incorrectly called CCAP. I was also a member of the Legislative Council Committee on Expungement that looked into this issue in 2006. Those committees brought together a diverse array of individuals, including prosecutors, defense attorneys, clerks of court, judges, lawmakers, privacy advocates, and media representatives. On all of these committees, recommendations similar to those in this petition were made and thoroughly debated, but in no case did they receive anything close to majority support. This petition is an attempt by a determined minority to achieve its ends by other means. Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council takes no position on whether more Wisconsin residents should be able to avoid criminal convictions. Our concern is solely with the parts of this proposal that call for the obfuscation and even destruction of court records. Just as we should not have secret courts, we should not have courts whose official actions are obliterated from public view. If this court or the legislature undercut the usefulness of WCCA as an authoritative source of information on our state's court records, our state's court system, then this void, as Justice Gableman intimated, will be filled by private providers who may not be as accurate in the information they present, and there won't be the same checks on correcting information that exists with the current system. Further, they may not be as scrupulous about making disclaimers and reminding users of applicable laws. And the petition as written would create vast new burdens on the justice system and lead to new inequities over how individuals are treated. The proponents of this petition assert that there is widespread misuse of the information on WCCA, most regrettably over charges that do not lead to convictions. But this contention is unsupported by anything other than anecdotal evidence. No studies have been done to confirm that this happens or how often. Rather, the proponents simply assert that employment discrimination is occurring because that's what some people believe. They never consider there may be other factors, like a tight job market or a lack of requisite skills. They act as though there are no employers anywhere who obey the law or members of the public who are capable of making rational judgments about public information.
But you don't deny that this may happen somewhere, sometime, probably wind up in your column.
No, but I'm not sure that the extent of the problem is to the level that it requires this radical fix. And I also think that it's much easier for people to allege that they are the victim of discrimination than to make a objective finding that that's in fact occurring. I recently spoke with a Madison defense attorney who supports this petition, and he mentioned to me that his firm just received about 100 applications for a single low-level entry job. I'm pretty sure that some of the 99 people who were passed up are blaming CCAP. The state of Wisconsin has perfectly good laws that prohibit employers from discriminating against job applicants based on criminal convictions that are not substantially related to a given job. And certainly it is illegal for employers to discriminate based on charges that do not lead to convictions. I submit if that there is evidence that such discrimination occurring that is strong enough to warrant sweeping changes in our court's records policy, then it is surely strong enough to warrant prosecution for violations of existing law.
Mr. Leaders, I can understand, and I do, and I've read your material. It's under tab 18 of the court's material. What short of expungement can be done to protect people?
I think the committees that were established to review policy for WCCA did a good job in terms of identifying opportunities to bring clarity to the records that are publicly available. Now when you go to a record in a criminal case, you get a page that flashes up. It says, this is what happened with this individual, and here's some information you need to know. In the case of a dismissed charge, it will say right there that the charge against the individual was dismissed as a matter of law. John Johnson, or whoever it is presumed innocent. Furthermore, it is against the laws of the state of Wisconsin to discriminate against this person in hiring.
Is there more that can be done like that? I'm looking for something that is short of expungement, something that people can agree on that would assist.
There are more.
And if not, maybe it has to be expunged. But what would you suggest?
There's more that was done. I mean, there are field, the way that the fields present themselves to the viewer was changed in response to these concerns. You have to go to the charging history to find what the original charges were, if the final adjudicated charge was different. That's what you see, first of all, and you have to work your way backward to see that someone was perhaps charged initially with a more serious offense. So there have been a number of changes made to the system to make it easier for people to draw accurate conclusions about the information that is presented. Is there more that can be done and should be done? I'm not sure it needs to be done at the level of the legislature or the court system. I think we have to do a better job of educating members of the public about the responsible use of public information and not respond to every objection to that information by moving to take it away.
Not all use is employers looking to evaluate a potential new employee. Mothers and dads use it to see about the girlfriends and boyfriends. Neighbors use it to check on their new neighbors. Let's set the record straight. I, as a mother, have never done that, but I understand that it might be possible. And I, as a neighbor, have never done that, but I understand that it might be possible. And so I echo the question, what about those ordinary people in ordinary situations who are affected that isn't employment, that isn't actionable under our state laws, but which truly does affect their everyday lives and relationships? How can we make it better?
I would hold that the citizens of Wisconsin are entitled to know what their court system is doing, to have easy access to information about what happened. And if that lets them know that one of their neighbors was charged with a criminal offense, or one of their neighbors has a history of speeding tickets, I think that is an acceptable outcome. I don't think that people automatically seize on this information to discriminate against the neighbors and their fellow citizens, nor in most cases where people are simply snooping, do they have any real power over the people whose records they're checking into.
Well, you know, the dismissals that are talked about.
Hmm.
You know, it's one thing, maybe you want to know if your neighbor had some prior violations and convictions, maybe, but what about the dismissals?
Sure.
What about the Department of, Agriculture that had a file that said you violated something and then it was dismissed? I mean, isn't this fodder for discussion?
Well, I would focus on the more serious dismissals, which involve criminal charges. The Attorney General's Office, the State Justice Department, made some good arguments in the letter that it wrote to the court on this matter, noting that the public has a right to know what prosecutors are doing and what courts are doing. And say a prosecutor is routinely bringing excessive charges or charges that do not lead to convictions because they never should have been brought, then the public has a right to know that this is going on. I have used these records to do reporting about prosecutorial misconduct. I've used these records to check about the racial disparities in the criminal justice system. There are lots of valid uses involved trying to get a picture of what our courts are doing. If you simply take every dismissed case and say you can't see it, well, then first of all, every prosecutor in the state will have a 100% conviction record on every case he or she brings. And secondly, we will no longer have access to information about prosecutorial abuses that do occur. I would say further, and perhaps my most important point is that what I think is most offensive about this proposal is that it assumes that the state's entire justice system, including your own role, is on some level pointless and irrelevant. Why do prosecutors sometimes dismiss charges based on new information? Why do judges try to administer fair courts and juries render just verdicts? Why do appellate courts review cases for error and the Supreme Court look to clarify how the law is applied? According to the petitioners, none of these things matter because the public will uniformly conclude that if a person is charged, he or she must be guilty. And thus may be freely discriminated against, even if this is clearly illegal, plainly immoral, and makes no sense. Further, the petitioners hold that the only way to stop this from occurring is to seal cases and shred records so that no one can see that these cases were ever in our courts. I think the people of Wisconsin are better than that. I think they have the capacity to understand that a criminal charge is not the same thing as a criminal conviction. They have the ability to apply reason and compassion in their assessments of others, and they are entitled to a maximum amount of information about the affairs of their government, including the records produced by their courts.
Thank you. Now, is there any other questions of Mr. Leaders? I missed my great opportunity. You're always interviewing us. It was my great opportunity to ask you questions.
Thank you.
Another time, Mr. Leaders. Thank you. William Keefe. William Jack Keefe.
Honorable Chief Justice and Associate Judges, I thank you very much for the time to come before you this morning. My situation is somewhat different than what I've heard thus far, but I just want to first of all mention that I filed with the court this morning a letter and a chapter in a book that I've written about a saga that has taken place during the past 15 years. And facts surrounding this particular document in CHAP, as Ms. Lisa Glick mentioned, Big Brother symbolism and demonizing citizens. This shows exactly how a person can be demonized. And in this particular case, it was a criminal misdemeanor filed against my son and our business, our log home business, in 2003. And that was at the same time that there was a great deal of court activity going on within the Office of Lawyer Regulation and also at the federal level. Now, this document shows that the case, criminal misdemeanor, was dismissed with prejudice, which, as the court knows, is very unusual in a criminal case, whether it be a criminal felony or a misdemeanor. But Judge W.M. McMonigal from Green Lake County looked for ways that he could dismiss this, and he asked the special prosecutor to motion that it be dismissed with prejudice so it could never be brought back again. And again, this, I believe, is part of the Big Brother symbolism and the demonizing of citizens who happen to get caught up in this legal system of things. Now, with that said, I'd like to back up to 1992, when I became involved and my son became involved with two Wisconsin attorneys in a business venture. They acted as our financial counselors, okay? And as a result of that, a very unusual and unbelievable thing happened. My son and I were put in a position where we were offered $150,000 in black market U.S. cash if we would join in an international money laundering scheme. Now, naturally, we refused. Some may not, but we did. My son and I refused. At that point, we were bombarded with civil litigation in Milwaukee County, Juneau County, Marquette County, Dodge County, two cases in Marquette County, and false criminal charges were filed against us in Juneau County, Vernon County, and Marquette County. Now, at that time, we couldn't afford an attorney, so I petitioned through a grievance the Supreme Court's Board of Attorneys Professional Responsibility. And as some members of the court may recall, that was at the time that there was a serious problem with the board. The administrator and the board were kind of back and forth having serious problems. There were allegations that the board was more attorney-friendly than grievant-friendly. So my grievance that was filed December 15th of 1995, I received the letter that it was put on hold until after all of the litigation was completed. Now, if you can just appreciate the position that I was in, not one day of law school, but yet confronted with several civil cases and three allegations that were criminal. So that situation brought about the demise of my family. My wife divorced me. One of my daughters has never spoken to me since because everybody believed that attorneys in Wisconsin can't be wrong. It has to be my son and I. So through the course of 1995 to 2000, I fought those cases at the civil court level, overturned them. Then I filed an action in the federal district court, Western District, which was a 42 U.S.C. section 1983 action. I named the Supreme Court's Bapper and the two attorney Arthurs as defendants. That finally brought about the investigation by the Office of Lawyer Regulation, which replaced Bapper. And in my lettering, I had sent excerpts from the report of referee Stanley F. Hack, which was filed October 15th, 2003. And on page one, it talks about the counts that one of these attorneys faced. Count one, respondent entered into prohibited transactions with clients in violation of SCR 20:1.88. Count two, respondent filed lawsuits, asserted positions, conducted defenses, and took actions that he knew would harass or maliciously injure others in violation of SCR 20:3.18. Respondent undertook numerous actions in an effort to needlessly increase the length and cost of the litigation proceedings in violation of SCR 20:3.2. Count four. Respondent made false statements of fact to a tribunal in violation of SCR 20:3.81. Count five, counseled and assisted a witness not to appear at a court-ordered deposition, conceal the existence of their attorney-client relationship, and to testify falsely in violation of SCR 20:3.4b. And then count six, engaging in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, and misrepresentation. Now, it took me many, many years, because as the court knows, this was filed in 2003, and an appeal was taken. In 2005, I sat here before the court and listened to Attorney James Ryer present the case to the court, and the court accepted the entire findings of fact and conclusions of law filed by the referee, Stanley Hack. In this document, it points out that we were provided legal services by the attorney and his wife. And it says, based upon the findings, in conjunction with respondents' business and legal relationships with Halco, he drafted business plans and proposals, including financing of the operation involving the Keefs, and entered into contracts with them. Thereafter, following the termination of their attorney-client relationship, respondent was involved as an attorney, separate party, Ronald Arthur, and president of Halco in civil actions filed in part or on behalf of Halco against the Keefs related to their business dealings in Milwaukee County, Marquette County, Dodge County, Juneau County.
Mr.
In addition,
Keefe,
pardon?
Your red light is on, and so I'd ask you to sum up quickly if you can.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the court has your papers that she filed today. They're in this black binder that you got. And your materials are also under our tab 21. So I want you to know the court does have that in front of it.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could just find one more item, Your Honor.
All right.
Paragraph 7. He also incorporated and provided legal services to American Russian Ventures Limited Most Incorporated, a company that may have been involved in financing the investment side of respondents' business activities with the Keefs, as well as its co-incorporator, Alexandre Trout. And then one more quote, Your Honor, and I will finish up. At or about this time, in the fall of 1993, respondent also drafted a memorandum outlining his business plans in the hardwood industry.
Mr. Keefe, could you just explain what is the remedy that you seek from this court?
Well, Your Honor, before I answer your question, could I read this last item, quote it, and then I'll answer your question?
Go ahead.
Okay. On behalf of American Russian Ventures Limited Most, he hired a consultant, Richard Ernst, to advise and evaluate the viability and direction of the project. Mr. Ernst was advised by respondent that the original financing would be provided by him and a Russian national whom he knew. The Russian national, whose identity was not disclosed at the time, was apparently interested in quickly and quietly repatriating large amounts of cash to the U.S. Thank you for your time, and to answer your question, I have been demonized during all of that time because of the involvement with these two attorneys. Okay? They were politically prominent. One was a former DA, and she was a chairwoman on the governor's Juvenile Justice Commission at that time. So it was an impossible task, almost, for me to be able to fight this situation without an attorney. So I had to spend my waking hours to get to that point where I was able to do that. And then that culminated in federal charges. I was able to have federal charges brought about. They ended up in federal prison, and he is still in federal prison at this time. But I believe, Your Honor, that each individual situation should be looked at, because this has destroyed my life, it has destroyed my son's business, and the only recourse I've had is to write a book on the entire saga going way back to 1992, and that's what I presented to the court this morning, is chapter 15 of that book. So, again, I've been politically demonized and under severe scrutiny by the system.
Have you studied the proposed rule changes that have been submitted by the bar?
I've looked at them, Your Honor, and as far as the expungement, I believe that the most damage is done on CCAP, because so many people, like in this case that I gave you this morning, Chapter 15, I was dismissed with prejudice. But many people in the public don't have the slightest idea what the difference is between with prejudice or without prejudice. You know, and again, they're not going to detect that that was an unprecedented situation to dismiss that case with precedent, because it was so lacking in probable cause that it should never have been filed in the first place.
Mr. Keefe, your chapter 15, which we just got today,
yes, Your Honor,
is entitled Wisconsin's Circuit Court Access Program Fuels False Criminal Charge and Extortion Scheme.
That's correct, Your
Honor.
And
your position is that it may have value, CCAP or WCCA.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it.
But that it also can be destructive, and you give your case as an example.
Yes, Your Honor. There's a great deal of detail there, and I think you will appreciate in reading the entire court
Mr.
for that
Keith.
Matter.
Mr.
Gabe, Keith, Justice Gabe.
I want to, first of all, thank you for being here. It's obvious you've been through a very, very stressful and terrible situation, and you've gone to a lot of effort, a lot of work, not only to remedy it, but also to try to let people know what you went through. You're the second speaker to reference George Orwell's book, 1984. Does it seem, the thought occurs upon hearing those references, that the situation with CCAP may be considered quite in opposite to what Orwell was contemplating back in 1949 when he wrote the book? The main themes that Orwell was putting forward were the deceit of government, the secrecy of government, the distortion of truth, Big Brother is love, Big Brother loves you, war is peace, etc. Whereas it seems with CCAP, the argument could be made that it is total transparency of what occurs in the government. You know, I assume that it was accurately reported in CCAP that your case was dismissed, so you were not found to be liable or guilty, whatever, whether it was civil or criminal, and that any interested party could find out on a step-by-step basis from proceeding to proceeding what exactly occurred. And so while CCAP seems to me to be promoting, and to many seems to be promoting, additional transparency and openness, even though you suffered as a consequence, because by the very fact of its reporting, your reputation and your interests were damaged. On the other hand, the government lies and hypocrisy that people are referencing in 1984 don't seem to be applicable in this particular situation.
Well, to address that, Your Honor, again, most people, most citizens, and in fact, the chapter that I gave you to read, this involved an individual who looked at CCAP and saw all of these cases that were filed against my son and I by two attorneys. Right away, the assumption is, wow, these guys must really be in trouble. They must have done something terribly wrong. Now, this individual that I write about in the book used that information to attempt to extort property and money from us, and then he used it to file false allegations, false statements with the Marquette County Sheriff's Department. So there's a case, Your Honor, where we were victimized because an individual sought out CCAP to see, at a time that my son was building a log home for him, to see what was in CCAP relative to my son and his father. And then he used that information deceitfully and criminally to file false charges and allegations against us. So there's a prime example, Your Honor, where the public can do those sort of things.
And what you're asking, I take from your response to Justice Prosser's question, is for a rule that would allow a judge on a case-by-case basis to say, look, this is a case that just ought not to be reported in CCAP. It just shouldn't be there.
That's correct, Your Honor. A motion to a circuit court judge who heard the case is very competent in rendering, you know, a decision regarding that particular case, and that's basically what I'm requesting of the court here today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Keith, and thank you. Justice Gableman gave you the thanks of the court, and I concur. Thank you. Honorable Robert Kennedy, Reserve Judge, Rhinelander.
Good morning, and thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you this morning in support of the State Bar's petition number 0907. It's difficult for me to tell you how odd I feel being here without a flock of high school mock trial kids.
Coming soon, yes. Judge Kinney.
With any luck,
March.
The absence of those kids, of course, denies Justice Crooks the opportunity to insinuate that some of those kids are my grandchildren rather than my children. Over the years, I have been asked to expunge scores, if not hundreds, of records of offenders under the prior version of Section 973.015. These requests were made on behalf of individuals under the age of 21 years at the time of commission and were made at the time of sentencing. Sometimes expunging was actually agreed to as part of the plea bargain between the prosecutor and the defense attorney. More often than not, I granted the request, but it was almost always conditional. It was generally conditioned on the offender successfully completing 18 months or 2 years of probation. I'd never heard before this morning that that might have been in violation of the statute, but I can confirm that that is the practice around the state by the trial judges. Very frequently, these requests came with media representatives present in the courtroom. Not once did any media representative, either at the time the request was made or at any time thereafter, object to the request or ask to be heard. Not once. Ever. If I granted the request, the earth did not shake. In fact, it was not even newsworthy. There was never a headline, Kinney expunges shoplifting conviction. No one was denied, quote, access to information citizens must have to act responsibly in a free and democratic society. It's a different issue completely, as far as I'm concerned. The people who really cared were the offender and his or her parents, and they cared a lot. For them, it was a big deal. For those whose cases have been dismissed or who were acquitted, our convenient and prolonged listing of their names amounts to a public branding, a stigmatization, a badge of disgrace, not unlike the posting of names on the tavern doors in earlier years in this state. Literally, for centuries, false allegations of criminality have been recognized as defamation per se. The damage caused by associating the names of individuals who have been found not guilty or whose cases have been dismissed, associating those names with criminal charges is, if anything, more serious when it appears on a public website sponsored by the government. So I ask you to do something to remedy this problem. My own personal view is that this petition is a very small step, but is a good step in the right direction. After listening to the presentations this morning, and especially the earlier ones, I believe that to some extent we've been dancing around the issue here. The legislature has established a policy of anti-discrimination. We, the courts, have come along and created CCAP. And it has been extremely beneficial in so many ways, as we all know. But it has caused the problem.
Would it be helpful, do you think, if CCAP were revised to have two separate planes, so that one plane was publicly accessed and the other plane could be accessed only by those on the bench? Or
okay. Well, Justice Rogenczyk, that actually exists right now. That is to say, all the juvenile cases are inaccessible, the guardianships, the mental commitments, so we have two planes.
Well, but we don't seem to have two planes for a lot of the things that have been complained about this morning.
Okay, should we expand that?
Right.
Yes. Absolutely. And the fact that there may be, you know, the proponents of the petition have been driven to expunction because of the common complaint that we shall not distinguish between
the computer record and the court record. That doesn't trouble me. The public access to computerized records is what has caused the problem. You know, there's this discussion about, do we have inherent power to correct it? Well, we surely have inherent power to do anything we want with CCAP because that's our creation. And I think the last thing we want to do is send this back to the legislature to have them muck around with our creation.
Well, I think it was a legislative bill that didn't get passed that suggested this two-part procedure and would charge $10 a year and keep a list of everyone who wanted access, and then would, you were on the list and you didn't hire someone, I may not have this precisely correct, you didn't hire someone, then you had to tell the person that you checked CCAP. And then if they found out that you were using that improperly, it would be a $1,000 fine. Now, that's very creative, and I did not make it up. So it's in our materials, and I believe it was one of the legislative proposals, which I'm busily checking for. Might be Assembly Bill 340. Is that which one it is? And there's an amendment to it. And there's also an Assembly Bill 663. We can check those out. It did do not quite what I've said, but close to it. What do you think of that?
And that's an ineffective solution. I'm sure that's occurred to you in looking at it. I mean, you know, Representative Schneider talked about the difficulties of getting a legislature which is elected on a two-year term basis to act on some of these matters. And if you really want to do something that would be unpopular with prosecutors, it is to invite them to prosecute the business people in their community who are using this. I mean, that's a completely absurd solution, in my opinion. It's not going to fly. So we need to do something institutionally, in my opinion, to correct this problem that is of a substantial dimension. And Mr. Leader says, well, where's the proof? Where's the study? Well, I mean, if you talk to people who hire people, they will tell you, they will admit it to you that they use this. And it's way bigger than simply in the private sector. But there are government entities that also use this in an improper way in violation of the state's Justice Gableman.
It seems to me that you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone who served as a trial court judge who would argue against the idea of expungement. But it seems to me that the proposal here, the petition here, is far broader than what our current understanding of expungement is. And one of the concerns I have is about the proper exercise of inherent authority. And you touched upon it when you made reference in regard to the proper exercise of inherent authority over the CCAP mechanism itself, which I agree with. But it seems to me the larger question here is presented by the statutory question of the procedures and limitations of expungement as they are currently in the statute books versus what the proposal is here. And I wonder if you could address that.
Yes, I certainly can and I will. First of all, I note that other states and the federal system don't seem to be troubled with this problem of a lack of authority to expunge. They just don't. I was going to do an article for the Wisconsin Lawyer magazine several years ago. Then I got sick and I retired and I threw out all my materials. But one of the things I had done was I had researched other states and I didn't find any other state. Well, generally the pattern is that states adopt or municipalities or counties adopt some form of computerization, and at the same time they enact rules that will permit expunction. So I just don't see the problem. But if the court is of the mind that they have no authority, which I think is, to these people, this sounds like too convenient and out to me. But if you feel that you have no authority, then just do it
Judge
through CPAP.
Kenny. So not your courtroom anymore.
That's right, and I apologize.
No problem. But my concern is I think what it sounds to other people like is important, but it, as judges and justices, I think we need to be focused on the proper limitation of the exercise of court authority. And if the legislature has acted one way and has instructed the members of the bench in a particular way, then where do we draw the line in terms of the exercise of the inherent authority?
Well, I agree with the comment earlier made that this is an area of shared authority, that the legislature has authority and the court has authority. What's troubling to me, however, is the idea that we can create CCAT, but we can't do anything about providing a problem that will solve the problems we created by its creation. And it may well be that the answer is a CCAT remedy. That's fine with me, but in the past, the argument has been made that, well, we can't have this variation between the records that are obscure in the courthouses and those that are available online.
Judge Kinney, maybe what you're suggesting is that while we can't overthrow the expunction statute or decide contrary to what the legislature has, we can decide what should or shouldn't be on CCAP, and therefore what shouldn't be on CCAP are dismissed cases, not guilty findings. That's, I think, what you're saying. Rather, people are using the term expunction, which has a special meaning in the law and has been legislatively determined. What I'm hearing you say is maybe the word's expunction, maybe it's not, but you created this creature, CCAP. It's created a host of problems. The public should have information, but the information you provide to the public on the World Wide Web ought to be convictions, judgments, cases that proceeded to a conclusion where the allegations were proven. Is that what I'm hearing from you?
Yes, in a word. I agree with what you've said, and I think that most of the presenters here and most of the other people who object to the whole, to some of the problems that have been created, would be very satisfied with that solution.
Because the records would still exist in the courthouse in the traditional manner, just not accessible by computer.
That's right. And that would be a huge step toward remedying the problem. But there are those who believe that there should be no difference between the official records in the courthouse and what's available on the CCAP computer, WCCA.
Judge, have you had a chance to either look at former Judge Carlson's recommendations to the Legislative Committee or to discuss this with him?
I have not, unfortunately. I have not been in touch with Judge Carlson for a time, and we have not had the opportunity to have that discussion.
We have a letter on file from Judge Dyke, who is supporting those changes, and we have Judge Carlson's letter on file, too. So I'll just
Do you want to summarize those for me or for anybody here? I mean, briefly, if that's possible.
In essence, he says, number one, let's expand the current concept of conditional discharge, exactly what you had talked about earlier. You know, at the time of sentencing, you do a conditional discharge if they go along well in the probationary period, number one. Number two, after a period of time, remove the record of criminal proceedings from the court's public access website of cases involving, number one, successful completion of this conditional discharge, or two, dismissal of charges. And we've just talked about that with Justice Ziegler. And then finally, he suggests eliminate the current expunction statute 973-015 entirely. So those are his...
Of course, the court wouldn't have authority to do that, would it?
Well, it depends on what this is brought under. Mr. Gunther brought it under the inherent power, but he also makes reference to 751-12 as pleading in practice. So I don't know where it sits. And if it's pleading in practice and procedure under 751-12, we have repealed those, whether correctly or not. So that's in response. For the rest of the court, Judge Carlson's recommendation is under tab 7. It was part of the Special Committee on Expunction of Criminal Records. You and I talked about it in the hallway earlier.
Yes. If I may, Justice Bradley, you had talked earlier about the fact that the information wasn't all just misused by employers or landlords, that parents use it and so on.
With the disclaimer that neither you nor I would ever do that as a parent or a neighbor.
Well, okay. The fact is, however, that the proposal that's before the court today wouldn't at all eliminate that use or the possibility of that use, because they're setting a time when cases become eligible to be expunged, and that time is, in the case of misdemeanors, 20 years out. By the way, Oneida County went online with CCAP in 1992. In other words, if this proposal were adopted, it wouldn't even be until 2012 when the first group of cases in Oneida County would even be eligible to be expunged. In the case of felonies, it's 50 years for a common non-Class A felony. Well, I mean, where exactly are we going to have the hearings? In the nursing home for those? I mean, my goodness. That's why I say this doesn't go nearly far enough, in my opinion. The light has been on for a while.
I'm sorry, but Judge Kinney, why do you think I can't expunge for 50 years?
The period of eligibility, and this, Mr. Gunther touched upon this, you could not entertain a motion to expunge a misdemeanor until the expiration of the minimum period for retention, which in the case of misdemeanors is 20 years. So no misdemeanors that have not been on the system for 20 years could be expunged even on motion.
Why would you have to expunge it if we're going to destroy the whole record? Or not retain the record.
That's record retentions versus
expunction. Right. I understand that.
Two separate issues.
I understand that.
They're related in the sense that you're not going to be able to expunge anything until the minimum period for record retention has run, which is 20 years in the case of a misdemeanor.
My sense is, looking at their petition, it is this, that a court may consider record expungement, number one, when authorized to do so by statute. Number two, and this gets to what you were just saying, on a motion of either party after the expiration of the minimum retention period, or number three, upon dismissal of a case, even before the end of the
convictions retention. That can be expunged will be those that have been on record for at least 20 years in the case of misdemeanors and 50 years in the case of felonies.
Not under C.
Sub 3.
Not under C.
And C is, I wish I had the thing in front
upon
of me.
Upon dismissal of the
case. Oh, yes. The dismissed cases.
Or in the event of a judgment of acquittal.
Right.
If a court believes expunction is necessary and appropriate in the interest of justice.
Yes.
I think that's where your people are talking. They're not talking about if it's authorized or required to do by statute. They're not asking us to necessarily change that. They're not saying that expungement after the minimum retention period. I mean, I'm assuming it'll be gone by then, so who cares? Maybe it won't be gone everywhere, and all counties don't obey this retention program anyway. It's C that could be done tomorrow that I think is at issue here.
Well, and we've talked here already about the idea that maybe not guilties and acquittals should just be out of there by a decision of the CCAP committee to remove those.
Well, that's why
I'd favor. That's not what this modest proposal says, though.
That's right.
This says you bring every one of those dismissed people. They, in order to get their stuff removed, their records removed, they have to make a motion in court. Every one of them has to make a motion in court. That's why this is not any kind of
That's
a
why
massive
I think
change.
Justice Prosser asked Mr. Fox, what are all other alternatives? And which is what I have been asking, and I think I asked Mr. Leaders, other alternatives. One alternative is, as CCAP has done before, drill down to see what the issues are and what can be done or should be done after a committee discusses it. Because if CCAP, when I say CCAP, WCCA, that is this on the web that's distressing people, not that it's in, with all due respect, Oneida County.
The courthouse records. That's right. And, you know, when we talk about public and open records, the people who access this stuff do it all secretly. If they had to go to the courthouse to get this, they wouldn't do it because they don't want to have their face seen there in many cases.
Any other questions? Just Prosser.
In the proposed rule 7206, 1C, this is upon dismissal of the case or in the event of a judgment of acquittal. It seems to me there is a condition in here that it be done within a reasonable period of time. If it isn't done right away, it's in a reasonable period of time. What is your interpretation of that phrase?
I think that, I mean, that expression has certainly been interpreted many times in our law, and I guess I would consult the case law and see if there was anything similar to what we're talking about here that would define it. I don't have in my mind a set number of years. I mean, to me, the more years a person has been good, the better, and maybe the more entitled they are to it being wiped out, either by way of remove from CCAP or by way of expunction.
Well, let's take a previous witness, Mr. Keefe. He spoke about his son in Green Lake County, I believe it was. He has issues himself. Do you believe that he, if he made the right case, could get any records expunged under this rule?
It's discretionary with our circuit judges, and if there's one group I have great, great faith in, it's our circuit judges and their ability to exercise their discretion properly. I cannot judge that in a vacuum as a hypothetical. But the sitting judge who got that petition would be in a terrific position to decide whether that was worthy of being removed or not.
Well, now let me give you a hypothetical. Let's suppose we're in Oneida County.
I guess I'm supposed to ignore that red light, huh?
No, the justices ignore
it. Suppose we're in Oneida County where you don't sit regularly anymore, and a case that you handled years ago, someone wants to make a motion for expunction. So this has to be considered by a different judge. What's the hearing? What's the process? What does the judge have to put on the record in order to do this?
Well, many of the same considerations, Justice Prosser, that we've traditionally considered under 973.015. The statutory language there is the same statutory language that they've adopted under sub C here with respect to not injuring the public but being of benefit to the movant. What would some of those factors be? One of the critical ones I would think would be the passage of a lot of time and no further bad acts. No arrests, no convictions. Also, what's a reasonable period of time? If expunction or removal from CCAP wasn't available for 18 years, and all of a sudden it became available, would I say, oh, you're too late, too much time has passed? I don't think so. Presumably, a reasonable period of time would be a reasonable period of time after the remedy was available, at least. But after the remedy is available, should somebody sit on their hands for a long time? No, they shouldn't.
What I'm really trying to get at, Your Honor, is the court considering a motion has to make a determination that this is in the interest of justice and then certain other findings. It's one thing if that's done immediately at the time of dismissal or acquittal or sentencing or something. It's quite another thing if that's done years after the fact, particularly by a different judge. Well, even if it's the same judge. I mean, I can't remember what happened yesterday.
You know,
you just talked about 18 years.
Yeah. And for a lot of people, they can't be good for one. And it will be an academic question for them if they've got 18 intervening convictions. We aren't going to expunge any of those.
Okay.
But if we've got a person who has been a good citizen, has been employed,
Wait a minute. The rule says that you can have things dismissed or acquitted. Some defendant comes in and is tried, and then the record is wiped out. I mean, we just issued a case last week that in the course of that case there was discussion of a defendant who was acquitted by a very skillful attorney. I think a lot of people say, how did this person get acquitted? I mean, these are not all... not all acquittals and not all dismissals are equal.
Well, I agree with that, and that's why I think it would be great to vest the judges of this state, the trial judges, with the discretion to look at all those facts and determine whether it's an appropriate matter to wipe it out. Or is it going to harm the public to wipe it out? Is it going to not give us the notice that we should have about some person?
If a motion is filed 18 years later, is that in the same case or is that a new case?
I assume it's in the same case. It's a post-conviction motion if the person was convicted, and if we're talking about that kind of crime, misdemeanor.
They were acquitted under the case, dismissed or acquitted.
Okay. Well, then we get into this whole business about reasonableness in terms of some of the factors that I've talked about. Were they employed?
Okay.
Did they pay their child support?
What happens to the record in the motion?
What happens to the record of the motion?
Let's say it's 10 years after a criminal event. The motion is filed for expunction, and the motion is granted. What happens to the record of the whole motion?
The motion and the rest of the file is expunged in the way that the statute specifically sets out it must be expunged.
Explain that to me.
All things I buried the... Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Morris. Yeah.
The current rule.
Yeah.
You were looking for the rule that tells you how to expunge
it. It's on page 3, and Mr. Maurer says it's the current rule as to what the clerk has to do, what the obligation of the clerk is when something is expunged. And that used to be very loose, and then it was pinned down some years ago when we found out that there were a lot of different people doing things in a lot of different ways that weren't really expunction. Now we've got a specific rule. It has to be followed.
What I'm really trying to get at is there's the record of somebody's conviction, either very recently or a number of years ago. That's what you want to get expunged. Are you going to expunge the whole record that is made to justify expunction.
Not from you, we're not. That is, it's always going to be available on appeal, but I would think that we are from the public. And by the way, the expunction rule doesn't shred anything.
It's
the clerk has to house it separately.
Well, it says electronically remove any automated non-financial record except the case number. So the case number stays there so it can be tracked. I mean, I'm assuming that's why. That was adopted by the court in 97, and it's 7206. Am I right? Yeah, 72.06. It's on the court's material at page 7 of Ms. Owen's memorandum. But it doesn't cover your question. It doesn't cover Justice Frantz's question, because he's saying the expungement itself is a record. I think this is what he's saying. Therefore, don't you have to seal that too?
That's from your view.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, Judge Kinney. It's nearing 12. I'm inclined to call a halt and see if the court would be willing to come back at 1 after lunch.
Yes, indeed. Yes, if that were fine.
That's fine.
Justice Rogensack, 1 o'clock?
Yeah, sure. That's fine.
Stableman?
That's fine.
Okay. The court will take a recess for lunch. It will be back at 1. I am now, for those here, on number 10, the 10th person. So we've got a ways to go. And after lunch, the court gets, and the Chief Justice gets, much stricter. So I want you all to think about what you're going to say and narrow it down, if you would, please. And I've got from number 10 to number 30. So it's 20 people who have appearances. Justice Frost.
As a point of personal privilege, Mr. Maurice has been doing this for years, and I hope you wouldn't be that strict with him.
Well, we'll see when we get to him. I make no promises, Mr. Maurice. All right, and Mr. Maurice, you happen to be number 13, which is not a good sign. Okay. We'll see you after lunch. See you at 1. And thank you all for coming.